You're listening to DottoTech, helping you get the most out of your technology wherever you use it, at home, at school, or at work. Brought to you by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. 20 years, the trusted voice of technology in Canada, Steve Dotto.
Hello and welcome to DottoTech. I'm Steve Dotto. Glad you could join us today. We've got such a packed show for you lined up today on the show. Art, can you believe how busy we're going
to
be?
I don't not even time to chat right now.
You know, one of the things, there's a big news story. I think it's a big news story. The producers of the Hurt Locker have petitioned or served orders to several Canadian ISPs to get names and addresses of people who've downloaded the movie. Does that send a chill up your spine?
I didn't do it.
Okay, you didn't do it. It's not me. We're going to be talking about that. I think that's a big issue. We're also going to be talking about social media and networking, and we got Sabrina Firminger coming on the show to talk about her self-published book. But joining me in studio now, Lindsay Smith of lindsaysmith.com, one of our social media experts. How are you, Lindsay?
Great. How are you?
You're saying great, but you're really not great because I know what's happening in your life. You're moving in a week.
In a few days.
Are you packed?
Half.
Half packed. That means that you're not even close to half packed.
No.
If you think you're half packed, there's no chance you're half packed.
You're probably right.
And it's stressful. You know, here's the thing to pay attention to, that in relationships, in couples relationships, facts prove that more relationships break down. The second most common time is a move. The first most common time is the death of a parent. The second biggest stress on a relationship is moving.
Okay. Well, we're doing okay so far.
The whole idea is not to talk to each other at all during it, I think.
We've done that. Yes, we just stay busy.
But the problem is that you then have expectation that the person is doing something and then they aren't doing it and then you get in trouble, especially men. And Art can attest.
Guys,
you don't
want to
ask
well-trained.
Me any relationship advice.
No, we do because we want to know where you went wrong.
Make that same mistake?
That's good. No, you're doing good lately. You're on an uptick.
Three's a charm, I guess.
Lindsay, let's talk about privacy settings, which is something that obviously we're not paying any attention to at all with you or with Art on the show this week. But last week or 2 weeks ago, I guess Facebook made a little bit of a splash, and slowly, because with their privacy settings, the interesting thing about Facebook is they don't seem to roll this out all at once. So certain customers get features or certain users of Facebook get features earlier than other users. And so some people are going, well, I heard there's new privacy settings, but I haven't noticed anything new. Or before the news even hits, people suddenly say, hey, my Facebook privacy settings are changing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've changed it a bit. Now, you've written a bit about it. What are they responding to? Is this a response to Google Plus or is it something that was happening before, do you think?
Well, I think speculation is that it's in response to Google Plus. We'll never know what actually happens behind the doors of Facebook during their strategy sessions. But Google Plus rolled out the circles, which allowed people to send out their status updates to specific groups of people. So I could have my coworkers, I could have my family, I could have my close friends, my acquaintances, and so on. And Facebook has kind of, they haven't gone into as much detail as Circles does, because Circles gives you a lot more control over it. Like, you can name all of those groups.
Well, in my mind, that was one of the real strengths of how Google Plus was approaching the whole social networking problem, because I could say I'm only going to send this to my kid's soccer team parents, you know, and you make them into a group, even though some of those people might be in other groups. If you just want a message about, hey, is anybody carpooling for the game, you've got 12 other parents that you could send it to as a message and build this group instantly, and nowhere near that level of control in Facebook.
Well, Facebook, it's funny because I actually set up lists on Facebook. It was called Lists probably over a year ago, maybe even longer. Everybody I've ever asked never uses it. So, but it existed. I think what they've done is they've just brought it more to the forefront. So now you can, when you're actually putting your status update in, before you could say public, or it wasn't public, it was send to everyone, I think,
and friends.
And now it's called public or everyone. I can't remember which
it's
one of the two
public.
It is. Yeah,
public.
Right, so it was everyone before, and now it's called public, which makes it a little bit more intuitive, I guess. And as well, now you can send to friends of friends, and then probably your list is. But it's funny, though, because I went in to do it myself, and I'm pretty technically savvy, and I found it more confusing on how to access my list now and create them. So I wouldn't say that feature is come has been any more user friendly, like that they've really made progress in that area. But they have added some other features. For example, when you sent it out to the status update out before, you could only send it out, choose at that point in time whether or not it was going out to everyone, your friends or your friends of friends. Now what happens is there's a little globe that shows up in the top right-hand corner, left, right. Are we in front of a mirror? In the top corner. You click on that and you can change it at any time. So before, if you accidentally sent it out to everyone and you didn't want everyone to see it, you would have to delete the whole thing, rewrite it, which was so annoying. So now they've fixed that. The other thing that they've changed is you can now actually select your location from your PC as well. Before you could just check into Google Places from your mobile phone, but now you can be anywhere and say, hey, I've checked into my home, which actually brings up something that you recently discovered.
Yeah, you've got to be careful with how you enable those maps and how you enable the Google location service or the Facebook location services, because if you're not careful, you can say you checked in. If you create a place that's home and you give it permission to map that, all of a sudden, everybody can see exactly where your home is. And I'm not sure. Well, certainly in our world, in your and my world, where we've got a lot of friends that we don't necessarily know that follow us by reading us or something like that, we don't necessarily want them to know our exact home address. No offense to anybody listening, but I don't want you to know.
You don't want someone showing up, you know,
that's
just
right.
being like, hello,
that's
I'm
right.
your
can
new
you,
best
can,
friend.
Can you help me? I'm having trouble getting my iPod to sync. You have to be careful with how you deal with those location-based. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be kind of a standard rule that's going to be good to follow as we slowly enable all of these geolocation services within our devices. Is that ability is you have to be it's the unintended sharing of knowledge, and that should be our fear. And it looks to me like Facebook hasn't really fixed that, because I know people who have unintentionally shared that already.
Mm-hmm.
Me.
And so who wants to stalk Steve?
That's right, but that's a bad thing. And it doesn't necessarily have to be you. It might be just somebody else within your family or a friend of yours, right? Mm-hmm. I've checked into Steve's house. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be really careful about how that information is going to be shared. So Facebook, it seemed to me, and I want to go back to the sharing of posts, it seemed to me that the main benefit of the current post, the new privacy settings for posts, is that I could by choosing everyone, start to broadcast to a wider audience and use it more as a media tool to give my comments about something that I wanted to share with everybody, making a global comment. So for doing something like even like marketing my products or marketing my show or doing something like that, it seemed to me I went, oh, cool, I can share this with everybody. And if anybody is searching for information on XYZ that I happen to be commenting on, they might be able to see my Facebook post and I want that. So I liked that idea from one perspective, but it didn't seem to me to give me the same precise control at this point as that we had in Google Plus.
Well, the other thing too with the privacy is the pictures. Have you ever had that before, where a friend posts all your
That's
pictures, or are you
next.
Going in that
I had
next?
It written down. That was next.
Okay.
Let's talk about tagging, because tagging, and that is something that where people have taken a picture of you, and then they tag you in that photo, and then everybody in your friends list says, "Hey, here's a new picture of Steve." That can cause problems.
Well, it shows up on your profile page. It shows up. Yeah, I've tagged people before and they've been like, can you please take me off? And I'm like, what are you hiding? But the fact of the matter is some people just don't want to be tagged in certain environments. So Facebook has now rolled it out where you can turn a setting on so that anytime you're tagged, you will be notified and you can review it before it goes live. So that's great.
That's not the default though.
No,
so you have to tell it to set it up so that when people tag you, it happens. My kids have a little bit of a war going on constantly. My two children that are in university, they will often tag each other into photos that they're not in. To either try and embarrass each other or more likely because they want the person to notice that photo for some reason. And I burnt ribs once, and my daughter took a picture of the ribs that I'd burned, and then she tagged them with my name. So if you look under Steve Dotto, you'll find some burnt ribs at some point, because she was not impressed with the job I did barbecuing that particular afternoon. So, but you do have to go in and turn on that setting yourself.
And it's pretty easy to do. You just click on the settings tab, which is right at the top once you're logged in, and it's about two questions deep.
I would encourage people to do that one. I think that's a really good idea, because with camera phones, and some of your friends, as you know, tend to overshare. And so if they're oversharing you because they, for some reason, and it's just controlling the environment. You know, I've often talked in my speaking life about how important it is to start controlling our image and our personality, our personal information from an image perspective, and down to the photos that are taken of you either on LinkedIn or Facebook or any of these places. Mm-hmm. And I talk about the wine and cheese. You know, you go to any seminar or you go to any conference, and there's usually a great wine and cheese, one of my favorite moments in the event. And they always want to take a picture of you with the organizers. Mm-hmm. And so there's no problem with a picture of you with a single glass of wine in your hand. That's not a big deal. But if somebody makes a montage of you over, say, a 3-year period at 15, 20 conferences, and there's 15 or 20 pictures of you with a glass of wine in your hand, that all of a sudden tells an entirely different story. Now, it doesn't matter that that's spread over 2 years, and it's perfectly legitimate, and we would all have a glass of wine
in our
hand.
Are you making fun of my pictures?
I haven't noticed your picture. But, you know, you have to – so I encourage people to do something like put down the glass of wine, right? Mm-hmm. And then have the picture taken and think about that reputation as you go ahead. Mm-hmm. Part of that is controlling the tagging of your photos. You know, what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break, and because I want to just come back with you for a few minutes to talk about some new stuff from Samsung, some new smart TVs, are they?
Smart TVs.
Okay.
I'm getting smarter.
You're tuned in to Dottotech.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. You're listening to Dottotech, brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.
Lindsay Smith of lindsaysmith.com is in studio. We've been talking about the Facebook privacy settings that they've changed, and there is one other setting that was changed.
Yes, you can block and unblock people. So imagine you've got an annoying ex and you hate seeing all their status updates anymore, but you don't want to quite delete them because then they know they're deleted. You can block them so you just don't ever see anything they do. And then say a couple weeks pass and you guys kind of make amends and you want them back on, you can unblock them and then they're back in
your life again. And then you read their status updates, they irritate you again and you re-block them. So this is to just it's like a suspension?
Yeah, essentially it just...
You're suspended?
It wipes them out. It just completely wipes them out for... I shouldn't say wipes them out. It doesn't delete anything. It just makes them not visible.
Okay. Now, if you delete a person as a friend, do all of their other status updates, if you go back in your history, does that all disappear too?
I've never tried it. That's a good question.
I've never tried it either. It is a good question.
You should get someone to try it and then post on your...
And you know, do your numbers go up and down of your friends? And sometimes they go down and you don't know who's deleted you? I always wonder if it's...
I've had many people comment on that. To be honest, I don't watch it enough to know. Like, I could lose 5 people and I wouldn't have a clue. But I've heard a lot of people get very upset because they're like, I can't figure out who deleted me. I feel like I've been broken up with. I'm very upset. And yes.
What did I do?
What did I
do?
Was it
that post about... Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So Facebook privacy settings changed. And our message to everybody listening is go in, play with the new privacy settings and enable... your control
profile review
called profile review
and places review, so you can control whether or not people can check you into other places. You can turn that on and off.
Okay, those are the two things that we should be checking out. Now, I guess you're on a better media list than me because you got invited to some swank event that I didn't get invited to in Vancouver. Who is it for?
Oh, Samsung and Future Shop were having a little party soiree. Actually, it wasn't a party at all. It was a day event, but they did serve cupcakes, and we learned all about the new
cupcakes?
Samsung smart TVs.
Cupcakes.
I didn't
get invited.
You didn't get a cupcake. Samsung. What
Art,
were they
did
thinking?
You get invited?
I'll check my mailbox. I don't think so.
They're in trouble.
Okay. Well, we'll have a chat with them. But they didn't give you a TV.
They didn't. No, I didn't get a TV.
I don't care that much. I can do without cupcakes. I could use a new TV.
It was so awesome, though, that I kind of want to buy one of their TVs. So
tell me about the new TV.
The new TV that they have coming out includes something called social TV. So it's the whole thing is more app enabled. So when you're looking through at your interface, it essentially has all these apps and icons, and you can download apps from this Samsung store. But it comes preloaded with something called social TV, which allows you to read and chat, read your Twitter feed or chat on Google Chat or Facebook while you're watching TV. So it actually has an overlay over the screen. So imagine
Art's got the biggest smile on his face right now. He does. I think he likes the idea.
I don't know. I think he's laughing.
I'm laughing, actually.
Yeah.
So, okay, so is this picture in picture, is this like, does it reduce the size of the screen or is it going to scroll right over top of things?
Whichever you want. You can pick either option.
Oh.
Isn't that cool?
I don't know. See, that's, isn't that what a tablet is for? Isn't that what I use my iPad for? So that I can be, and so that everybody in the room can't see? See, I don't, that's a very solo activity. Watching TV, because whose Twitter feed are you going to go with? Whose Facebook updates are you going to go with?
Well, I think that it's something that television programmers will probably start building into the content so that you can learn more about what's going on. You could actually use hashtags. Like if you're watching a certain show, you can be commenting on the clothing, commenting on what's going on and kind of seeing the hype and actually having a more rich multimedia experience.
That's an interesting thought. Now, if people who've gone to conferences and are Twitter savvy are starting to understand how Twitter is expanding that the group dynamic of that event, because there's multiple conferences or multiple seminars going on during a conference, and people will be tweeting out the comments from the speakers as it goes.
I have a really hard time attending conferences and actually sitting through the whole thing. I'm just one of these people that has difficulty paying attention for a long period of time. And I went to one and I used Twitter the whole day and I had so much fun. So much fun.
Did you
it changed
learn anything,
the experience.
Though?
It I did. And you know why? Because people keep retweeting the brilliant things that come out of the speakers' mouths, and you can tune out the boring stuff and pay attention to the good stuff.
And I have to say, as a speaker, as soon as I step off stage now, I'm checking mentions of Dottotech on Twitter to see what people have commented. And I'm really upset if somebody says something that I said was lame. Like I'm looking to.
But it's a learning experience though, because then at least you know you're lame right away. Just kidding.
Thank you. Thanks so much for that. Okay, but getting back to television with this, which was the smart TV thing. So these overlays are, is it going to be primarily a Twitter thing, do you think? Or is it going to be a Facebook thing? What
they have the three options. So you choose whether or not you want to look at a Twitter feed, you want to look at Facebook status updates, or you want to participate in Google Chat.
Okay. Oh, so you can chat with your friends while you watch. And that's probably going to work for these reality shows. It might be good for sports. I could see that as a thing for sports, you know, complaining about referees' calls and that sort of thing. And how the NHL just rips the Canucks off over and over again. Oh, did I say that out loud?
I'll edit that in post.
Thanks so much. Nah, let it go. Is there a keyboard? Is the remote changed as a result?
So that's an interesting thing too. So the back side of it's a regular remote on the front side, and on the back it's a QWERTY keyboard.
Oh, so you got a big fat remote.
It's not bigger. I would say,
thumb typing. Thumb typing.
Yeah, thumb typing. It's not huge, but it's probably about the size, a quarter of the size of a regular keyboard.
Okay, again, now the battles for the, this is a solo experience. The issue that I have is television. At least in my family, is a community event. We all get together, we watch TV. This is not that, because if one person is commenting, the battle for the remote for what's being said, and then the fact that that person is on a slightly different entertainment track than everybody else. I can see where it's going to be there. In our family, when we are watching stuff like that, one person's on an iPhone, another person's on an iPad. I mean, we do some of these things, but having all that information shared on the big screen, it's going to take some convincing. Are the TVs special in any other way, or is it just?
Well, the ones that I was, they had plasma and they had the LED, so that's more energy efficient.
The LEDs
truer blacks,
nice.
Like plasma. It was an inch thick, which was beautiful, very light. It has the ability to come. You can buy a Skype camera, and it has full Skyping ability on it as well, which was so cool because you can see like grandma and the big screen. I'm still trying to get my grandma on Skype, but I just thought that was such a neat experience.
So you should get this in the new house, in the new digs. Invite me over and I'll take a look.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay. For more of Lindsay's sage commentary, visit her at lindsaysmith.com. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Steve Dotto, and you're tuned in to Dottotech.
MacTech, brought to you by MacStation, your Apple solutions experts.
It is time for this week's MacTech feature. Joining me in studio, as is his custom, Chris Miller.
How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm supposed to ask you. How are you, Chris?
I'm good.
Good. It's a host flaky relationship.
I thought we were developing a rapport.
Flaky or flunky?
I'll take flaky over flunky.
Don't overstretch your position, sir. Let's talk today about the forgotten iPods.
Which ones are those?
That would be the iPod Nano, the iPod Touch, and the iPod Oh, I see. I forgot.
You sort of experienced it while you were discussing it.
That was the little guy. The little guy. What's the little guy?
The shuffle.
The shuffle. Because everybody has an iPhone now. I still have an iPod Touch that I use for my audiobooks and to listen to my podcasts and some tunes occasionally. I actually have an iPod Classic because it's big hard drive
that has
my music library plugged into the Bose sound dock in the family room. But I digress. Mm-hmm. Talk to me. We haven't talked about them in a long time.
Well, we haven't because, as you said, they're very much the forgotten members of the Apple family, if you will. They're the redheaded stepchild that nobody really likes and they put in the corner. Yet they're always there. I mean, for instance, the iPod Classic is the device that everybody has on their boat or at their cabin or in the car. Just a giant brick of music. Just 120 gigs of music.
160,
an insane amount of music.
The black U2 edition, I think, is mine.
That was your favorite? The Bono?
No, it's just the one that I got.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't really like it better than any others, but
fair
it was
enough.
The one that they sent me at the time.
Right.
I didn't actually pay for it.
Ah, the joys of the tech celebrity universe.
That's right. That's the difference, again, between host and flunky.
Can I go back to flaky? I'll take flaky over
flunky. Okay, flaky.
Of course, the other one is the shuffle, my personal favorite of the pods.
Because you like to run with it?
Actually, I do.
Okay.
I use it at the gym, and it's a tiny thing, and especially if I'm giving it as a friend to a present, whichever you choose, you can clip it onto yourself. You don't even feel that it's there. It's just so little. It's just a little tiny thing of music, exactly what an iPod should be.
Yeah. And are they still selling well? Do you still see them flying over the store?
Those are easily the most popular.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just surprised.
Yeah. I mean, the only ones that are arguably more popular than the shuffles would be the touches.
Okay.
Which are actually being sold much more as game platforms, rivaling the 3DS, than really as a music device. The number of apps and games and bits that are making and stuff, and the number of kids you see with these, it's stopped being an iPod. It's a gaming device,
And it's online. They've all got Wi-Fi built in, so it's easy to get online. Well, the one that we've left out is the little Nano, which I think is the cutest.
The Nano is neat. It's kind of in between worlds. It's got a touchscreen, but you can't put apps on it. It's got full color. You can look at pictures, but not videos, because the video card in it just can't support it. A lot of people, actually, the most common use for it once it came out was as a watch.
Oh, yeah, because there was straps that you could get that you could turn it into a watch.
Yeah, clip it right to your wrist and plug in some headphones if you felt like it, but it was just sort of a neat watch that also had photo capability.
But it's almost like teasing and it's almost too close to being a real touch by the fact that you do have the multi-touch screen, you do have that graphic ability to be able to see pictures on it, and so you feel like you should be able to do more. And the actual cost difference between the Nano and the iPod Touch isn't that much to give that up.
Yeah, I mean, the Nano's $150, the Touch is $250, and then if you compare it, the Nano to the Shuffle, which is, I think, really a closer competitor to the Shuffle than the Touch, the Shuffle's $60.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, if you just want something to play music, you get a Shuffle. If you want something that's the full big, the phone without the phone, is as the statement says, then the Touch is the preferred way to go. And then the Classic is just the giant brick of music sitting in the corner.
Yeah, which is the Classic.
Yeah.
And it's still...
I really dig that they've kept pretty much the same design for the last 10 years. It's exactly the same. It was perfect. It was right on the way out. It was just good.
Okay. So if you're going to be a jogger, if you're going to be active, if you want just really simple music.
The Shuffle,
which, remember, you can't manage it from the Shuffle. You have to manage it all from iTunes. You have to set up your playlist and that sort of thing. But really, for the workout person, that's good. And now, is it large enough to hold a full audiobook?
It's 2 gigs.
2 gigs. Oh, that's plenty of room for an audiobook because I like the audiobook idea.
Sure.
So good. Okay, and then the Nano.
8 or 16 gigs, ton more music. As I said, I think it's a really, really cool design idea. I just don't think its time has come. Maybe it's like a second generation Air. They're going to come up with a third generation. It's going to be mind-blowing, but I don't know if it's there yet.
And the Touch does. And then when the Touch, which we're into web browsing, we're into playing games, we're into doing all sorts of extra things.
Yeah.
And then that's it. And then finally the Classic.
And then the Classic.
Which is Classic.
Love it.
As are you, sir. You're the Classic Flaky. today.
You know, I'm going to go ahead and take that.
Take it as a compliment. It's meant this one. Chris Miller from MacStation. If you want to check out any of the iPods, Chris will be happy to walk you through the entire product line down at MacStation.
Come on down.
MacTech is brought to you by MacStation, your environmentally friendly solution. Trade up to the newest technology. Save taxes on the new machine. Give a second life to your old Mac. MacStation. Who said business and pleasure don't mix? You're listening to DottoTech, brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.
To boldly go where no one has gone before.
I think it was just about 2 months ago that we first had Sabrina Firminger on the show, and she joins us again. How are you doing, Sabrina?
It's a very exciting time for me right now.
I think so. So let's go back. Sabrina is our author, and I wanted to do a story a few months ago on self-publishing books because there's all these services on the internet where you can publish your own books. You can become a self-publishing author, self-published author. And Sabrina was in the process, and so you've given us two updates. So back to our original conversation, you were thinking about, or you had at that point determined which service you were going to choose, and you chose iUniverse?
I did, yes. Self-publishing was my first choice, and mm-hmm. I had researched various companies and various options, and I had decided on iUniverse, so one of their premium publishing packages, mm-hmm. which guaranteed placement in Chapters bookstores somewhere across the country.
Which you found very exciting.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, did we talk about the dollars and cents involved? It was a couple thousand dollars for the package.
It was expensive.
Yeah, it wasn't cheap, but then when you consider how fast this happened mm-hmm. in comparison to the traditional way, it might be money. It might be, as far as time savings alone, you probably saved quite a bit. So then we brought you on partway through, and you were just in the process then of finishing up the editing of the book, and you would determine that you were going to use some more services than you'd originally planned because mm-hmm. in the editing process you found there were some holes, and you wanted to make sure that your book didn't have, I guess, some of the omissions that you saw in some of the other self-published works.
Yes, production required a lot of patience because I was so eager to get the book into the marketplace, and it took me more than 2 years to write it, and I'm so proud of it. But at the same time, I wanted to ensure that the product that got out there was top notch, and so that required me giving it to as many people as possible, hiring as many different editors as possible to really vet it and to proofread it, and then I even found, I read it several times, one of the final copies several times, and I had thought it was okay, I'd given it to the last proofreader, and, she found a couple missing letters and things. So that is something for self-published authors. Take your time with the editing. It's so important. I've also vowed to myself, I'm never going to read it again.
Oh, okay. Because you'd seen it so many times.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can't make any changes at that point either, so you want to change phrasing or something like that, and you can't do that. You're just cleaning things up.
I'm standing behind it right now, though. I'm really happy about it.
So then this month, you said, it's here. They finished the publishing, and you got your first – did you order 100 books, you said, that you brought in?
Well, I ordered – so they sent me a hardcover copy with the jacket and everything, and they sent me a paperback copy, and I was – thrilled.
Emotionally, where does it rank seeing it?
Almost as exciting as holding my little baby daughter in my arms for the first time.
Was it that much?
It was really exciting because, I worked on this for more than 2 years.
Okay.
It's so vulnerable and exciting and scary to because I've written it, but now that it's published, I'm sending it out into the universe.
Okay.
And so...
Yeah, so now a whole different process begins. But this mm-hmm. is a process that is probably you're a little more familiar with.
Yes.
For those of you who don't know, Sabrina's day job is as a publicist, so
yes.
you're used to the promotion of this sort of stuff. But now that process begins.
Yes.
But as a self-published author, a lot of them aren't going to have your background as far as promotion. What should they be doing, and what are the keys now to that you think as far as getting this book out?
Well, I think the main thing, as far as production went, patience was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now with the marketing part, patience is part of it as well. It's not enough that my listing is up on Amazon or on Chapters or Barnes & Noble or mm-hmm. all of those things. In my opinion, a 2-year process. And I've identified social media. That's going to be a big one. It has been a big one already in drawing interest for the book. Seeking out reviews on indie book sites as well. There are so many of them. I'm trying to get people to read the work. Contacting the media. I'm also, because it's sci-fi, I'm considering renting a table at some of the big sci-fi conventions in Toronto and on the west coast of America. Social media is becoming the tool that people are really relying on to market and to sell their books, specifically Twitter. I follow a lot of authors on Twitter. I've also, over the last few months, been trying to connect with people who I think are my audience as well. There are some dangers with using Twitter as an author. There is the danger of spamming your followers. I look at Twitter as... It's an exercise in trust. You follow somebody because you trust that they're going to be posting interesting things. And if all they're doing is just spamming out links to their Amazon listing, you know, that's a really quick way to unfollow, get unfollows. So I'm really resisting doing that.
And I would think that for some authors, self-published authors, Twitter is going to be a lot easier. If you were, say, a biographer and you've been written about some people and there's news happening around that person or around their activities, that's going to be a fairly easy thing to do. Or if you're writing about, you know, anything that's nonfiction, there's a news angle. Tweeting out about fiction, that's got to be a little bit more of a challenge.
What I'm learning is that there's an audience for anything out there, and they do congregate on different blogs and on different sites and on Twitter, you know, and that's the wonderful thing is that people will search for the keywords that interest them and, you know, they'll find me or I'll find them. And, you know, I've met so many people who are, you know, they love science fiction. They love writing. They want to learn about writing. They are interested in works that are set in Vancouver. They're interested in, I've had people find me by typing in, they tell me sci-fi chick lit. So, you know, there's an audience out there for my work. And I believe that so much. And that's why I've spent the time and the money and the emotional creative energy trying to put this work out into the universe.
Okay. So now I am holding in my hand a copy of The Healer. It's how many pages is that?
216.
And you're not reading it again.
No, never.
Is it got a sequel potential?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, it's based on a dream that I've actually had for more than a decade, where people that I love or animals that I love would be injured in some way, and then all of a sudden I would find that I would have the power to heal them just by calling the energy of the universe to my hands. So one day I just decided to explore that in science fiction, which is a genre that I have loved since I was yay high. And so now I have explored this idea. I haven't had that dream again. And, you know, when I hold that book in my hands, I know that the 9-year-old version of me that wanted to write a novel would be really proud.
Okay. Well, you're going to give one away. Now, we're going to let people choose if they want the soft cover, if they want. Can you arrange for people to get the downloadable version if they're interested in that?
Yes, I can.
Because it's available in all of the major formats?
Yes. That's been the wonderful thing about iUniverse is that they have set it up so that it's available in all the formats and on all the major sites, retail online book retail sites.
Well, I don't like giving away something for nothing. So if we're going to give one of our listeners a copy of your book, which I'm happy to do, and I know you're happy to do, I think we're going to have to ask for something in return.
Okay.
So I think if they agree to review the book, Then we can send it. So what I'll do is I'll set up a little post on the website, and people can register, and we'll pick a winner, and then you can contact them, and I'll hand it off to you guys. But they have to write a review. It doesn't have to be positive. It's not good.
No, I want to know.
you do want to know. But the whole idea is to start to create some awareness, because you know you keep using this word out to the universe. Well, it's a new universe, and I'm fascinated by the fact that. I believe if this had been 20 years ago and I'd talked to an author as they were at the stage you were in when you first came into these studios, that it would be 2 or 2.5 years later that we had this next interview.
Right.
With you, it has been a, what is it, maybe 3 month, probably 3 month process.
Yeah, it's
from
been
the first time that I talked to you when it was embryonic or as far as the fullness of the project, to the point that it's now done. It's in a new phase. It's in now the marketing and publicity mm-hmm. phase, and the writing and production phase is over.
Yes. It's amazing. It is truly amazing what you are able to do now. You know, just sitting at your desk or lying in your bed with your laptop or mm-hmm. whatever. And because of this, like, this is the reason that self-publishing was my first choice.
Well, the next time we're going to bring you back after we hear about reviews and stuff, of course, mm-hmm. if your book, as long as it doesn't suck at all.
it was number 8 on Amazon.ca sci-fi list this past weekend.
That was awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
I won't ask you what it is now, but it's not quite a number. But I want to have you back on in December when you get some reports of the numbers, so we can start to see how it's actually moving ahead. SabrinaFerminger.com. We'll have links at our site. Yes. We're going to be giving away copies. Thanks so much for coming in. And on behalf of all of us, congratulations.
Thank you, Steve.
I saw the Canadian dollar briefly dipped beneath the U.S. greenback, just briefly, and it made me think, man, I just don't understand what goes on in the world of money. I just don't understand what goes on in the world of money. But luckily, I've got advisors that help me. And you know who my most important advisor is?
Billy Mack.
Billy Mack, my mortgage guy. If you are considering a new mortgage, if you have a mortgage, if you haven't bought your house yet, but you need a mortgage, go to a mortgage broker. And I think the best one, BillyMack.com. He will make sure you get the best deal possible. He shops the rates from all of the major banks to make sure that you get the best mortgage that you possibly can. BillyMack.com with an I.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. You're listening to Dottotech, brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.
As I mentioned off the top of the show, the rights holders of the Hurt Locker have determined that they're casting a wider net in their copyright infringement efforts, and they've cast eyes covetously upon Canadian miscreants, and so they've ordered several Canadian ISPs to provide names and addresses of individuals who were deemed to infringe on their copyright. So joining me in studio, when we talk about this stuff, got to talk to lawyers. So I've got Danielle Lemon in. She is of Danielle Lemon Law Group. You guys specialize in copyright and entertainment law, so thanks for coming in.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, that must have warmed your heart seeing that story coming across the wire this week.
I can't say it warmed my heart, but certainly as a legal observer, this is going to be the biggest P2P litigation case that we've seen in a while.
So P2P...
Peer-to-peer.
Peer-to-peer. Okay.
Right.
For the talking about the peer-to-peer file sharing
right.
networks. This all kind of harkens back, you know, if we think about infringement and using the internet for stealing things, it goes back to hacking games and stealing games, and then music sharing was huge for a period of time. And anybody that tried to be legit in the music sharing world ended up going away. And anybody that wasn't legit, the most part still around, but there was lots of lawsuits all through the early 2000s. And now with the torrent sites and the increased bandwidth and the increased compression capabilities of our computers, this is entering into the television and video and film market. And it's interesting that the first, I guess, real big trial of this is going to be based on the Hurt Locker. Is there anything in the makeup of the individuals or the movie that stands out that says this is the logical place for this battle to happen?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, isn't it? Because it was a tiny movie.
It was $12 million spent on it, and they made that money on the first in the first weekend that it ran.
Right, and yet Voltage Pictures, which is the company that produced the movie, is the one instigating these lawsuits, and it is it's really interesting. I can't think there's nothing in the judgments that I've read so far that suggests why this particular movie is being used mm-hmm. as this sort of test case for these types of lawsuits, but it's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So what exactly are they saying, and what are they doing? They've started in the States gathering names of people who have shared the file.
Right.
And they're, I guess, going to be suing those people at some point. And just this last week, they is the proper word, served three Canadian ISPs with search warrants?
Right. So what they've done is they've gone, the producers of the film,
Voltage,
have gone to the Federal Court of Canada in Montreal, and they were seeking an order that three ISPs, so mm-hmm. I think it's Videotron, Bell, and Cogeco.
Yeah.
Must deliver up the names of about 30 of their subscribers.
Yes. Now, they didn't say that in the original one, but both Bell and Videotron in their responses to the media said it's less than 10 each. So
right.
It's not a lot of people. It's thousands.
No, it's under 30. And these people, the producers have alleged in their complaint that these people, based on their ISP addresses, have downloaded or shared unauthorized copies of this movie. The Hurt Locker. And so they're saying, we have no way of identifying who these subscribers are ourselves. ISPs, we need you to give us the personal information of these people so that we can prosecute them for copyright infringement.
Now, what stunned me is our ISPs just rolled over and said, sure. Why would they do that?
It's an interesting question, isn't it? And it's a bit of a retreat from what happened in our last big peer-to-peer litigation in 2005, which was the music industry mm-hmm. case, the BMG case, where certain ISPs were vigorously defending their right not to disclose that information. And the reason that they do that is because by law, they have to protect, under our privacy legislation, they have to protect the information of their customers, mm-hmm. and they can only release it with the consent of the customers or by court order. So mm-hmm. normally, they vigorously defend their right not to give that information up.
So in 2005, there wasn't a court order. So it isn't the ISPs, it's the courts. It's the Canadian courts that decided, and they chose a Quebec court to use this for. Is there something significant there?
No, I mean, it's a federal court. Okay. What we're talking about here is copyright legislation, which is federal.
Okay.
So it's Canada-wide. And what they've done is they've asked for an order, it's a disclosure order. So okay. these ISPs have to give them information. And in order for those company, or in order for the producers of The Hurt Locker to be able to get that information, they have to prove four things. So they have to prove that there's a prima facie, meaning sort of on its face that there's an infringement case happening.
Okay.
They have to prove that they can't get their information by any other means.
Okay.
They have to prove that the person they're asking for the information from, so the ISP in this case, since they're not a party to the case, they have to prove that that party is more than just an innocent bystander, that they're somehow involved.
Okay.
So the ISP in providing services to the subscribers is somehow involved. And they have to show that the infringement of the copyright outweighs the risk to those individuals' privacy rights. So to me, that's the really key issue here, is we're weighing copyright and intellectual property rights and the right to privacy. And so those are the four things that the courts are going to have to look at in order to grant this order. And in the case of this Montreal decision, they've said, yes, the right here to protect intellectual property rights and to make sure that we maintain an environment where creators have the incentive to create outweighs the disclosure of these people's personal information.
Who speaks at this point for the people whose names are being brought forward? Because we know that this movie company has massive amounts of legal help at very highly paid and talented, I'm sure.
Right.
There has to be an argument from the other side.
Right.
Who argues for the other side?
Good question. That's a really good question. And at this point, some of the commentators are saying, who does stand up for those people, and have those people been notified, and has the ISP talked to them and let them know that this might be happening and that their information is going to be disclosed mm-hmm. so that they can adequately seek legal assistance if they need it, or at least work with organizations, advocacy organizations, and may be able to help them. So, right, that's an excellent question. We don't know yet.
Mm.
And it's a fair question whether those people know that they're even involved in that lawsuit yet.
The other thing that concerns me, and maybe I'm just, kind of overreacting, is how this is flying under the radar, how it just seemed to come out of the blue and get submitted, get passed. The information has already been submitted to these to the movie company. So it all happened, the same day as it hit the news, basically. With
mm-hmm.
And I'm looking on opennet.ca. I'm looking mm-hmm. on the different sites, and I'm not seeing any commentary about it whatsoever. Does that
yeah.
surprise you?
It does surprise me. There was something on CBC News this afternoon, and that was the first thing that I'd seen. And this has been going on, you know, for more than just this morning.
Yeah.
So it is interesting that this is the first we've seen. I think it's because it's a really touchy issue here, and it's a really touchy business issue for some of these ISPs. We think when we do business with a large corporation that our information is secure, and we're not always prepared or not always well-versed in the rights that ISP has to disclose that information. So
this might be a bit of an unfair question because I know lawyers like to be right. Do you sense that this is a case where they're going after the really big file sharing, the people that are you know, the torrent sites that are, or the torrent members that are really sharing a lot of files and downloading and more than viewing it themselves, but really serving it out to a larger community? Or do you think they're randomly picking people to make an example of?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think that given the magnitude of the lawsuits that we've seen in the U.S. and Canada, I think this is a concerted effort to deter people from illegal file sharing.
Mm-hmm. And that might be the result is this.
Right.
Is if you are, we're going to go and download a movie to watch tonight or download a TV show to watch tonight,
right,
you're going to take a step back and think twice because we don't know who
you
the
don't
victim
know
is.
You don't know. That's right. And I mean, it's questionable whether that this is the most effective way to deter people from infringing intellectual property rights. There's been a lot of talk about copyright reform in Canada for a number of years. We had a bill that was tabled in Parliament that unfortunately died with the last election. That one of the initiatives was going to be shutting down pirate sites.
Yeah.
To me, that's a more effective way to crack down on piracy than going after individuals.
Yeah.
That bill was
but
also...
But those are all beyond the reach of Canadian law for the most part. I mean, Pirate Bay, which is the biggest,
right,
is based overseas. So,
right.
So, how can you close that down?
Sure.
This is a worthwhile
And that's the argument that's going to be made, right?
Well, maybe we should just take a step back in history just for a moment here and look at this, look at what's happened before. Because before we had these issues around films and movies, we did have it around music.
Right.
And the Canadian recording artists and the CRA.
CRIA.
And the RAIA in the States, they have fought several different angles of battles. Now, the Canadian angle was one that drove me crazy because it was like, we're all guilty, charge us all for piracy and make us all pay for it. And they looked at the magnetic media that we stored the music that might be downloaded on and tried to make us all pay for anything that we put on magnetic media, which I thought was one of the most boneheaded things. And the fact that they actually managed to push it through, just staggering. In
right.
the States, they went a different route.
Yeah.
In the States, they decided to make an example of a small group of people, and they chose individuals. They did this fear tactic of suing individual families and trying to, you know, take away hearth and home and scare people that way. And the music industry, especially in Canada, had an interesting reaction to that. In the fact that Network Records here decided to actually pay the legal bills of people who were being sued for downloading Network Records artists, which I thought provided incredible leadership in that case.
Well, I mean, it's a balancing act between maintaining a good client base and a good customer relationship
exactly.
and protecting the rights of your copyright holders, right?
Yeah.
And that's always the balance is how do we protect people's rights in their intellectual property so that they continue to create, so that we continue to have a vibrant arts industry with people's access to that, access and enjoyment of that material, right? And that's always the balancing act in intellectual property. Mm. And there's always public policy arguments on the other side, which is why it's such a fascinating area of law for me anyway.
Yeah. So what do you think the net result is? I mean, I won't ask you if you would download anything, but I've got my own situational ethics regarding the download of material. I figure if it's ever been seen on free TV, I can't see why I can't download it and watch it whenever I want. Now, I'm sure I don't stand on firm legal footing as far as that goes, but it just makes common sense to me. And if I've bought it once, if I've paid for it, if it's an album that I bought and I've lost it in a movie or something, I don't see why I should buy it again. Now, again, I don't think I'm on firm legal footing,
right?
But as I say, in my situational ethic world of Steve,
right,
it's what I'm doing. What do you think the result of this action is going to be on the greater file sharing community?
To be honest, I feel like this is a situation where it's going to be really hard to get the genie back in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people are used to being able to access the content they want, whether that's legally or illegally, but they're not willing to pay exorbitant amounts or pay again for mm-hmm. something that they feel that they own or that they have a right to. And that's a challenge because at the same time, as I said, you want to protect the rights of the people who create and produce this material that we're all enjoying. So I think law and public policy have to catch up. I think business needs to catch up and needs to reflect the reality of making content accessible to people how and when they want it for a price that they're willing to pay so that we don't have these situations where people have to go to a Pirate Bay or some illegal file sharing site.
What better example than Netflix?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. So let's pay a subscription fee that, you know, I'm comfortable paying.
Yeah.
It can fit in my family's budget and I can access all the content I want and I'm doing it legally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the right way to go. And I think that we need to catch up. Business needs to catch up so that we don't have people who are, breaking the law every time they want to go and watch something on their computer.
Yeah. That's what most of us are doing. I wonder what percentage of the greater Vancouver area tonight is going to break the law. But I would say it's fairly high.
Yeah. I mean, and because it's easy, right?
Yeah.
So until it's as easy for those people to legally access the content, we're going to have this problem.
And it doesn't make sense. I can watch it free on TV. And the fact that I wasn't there on Tuesday night to watch it and I want to watch it now on Wednesday night and I can download it at Pirate Bay, I don't understand why I can't do that. And I don't understand why I can't do that.
Right.
So that's
and
the issue.
Lots of people don't, Steve.
Yeah. Lots of people are doing it.
Lots of people don't.
Danielle, what's your website?
My website is www.dllg.ca.
And I hope that after my disclosure that I don't require your professional services at some time in the future.
Well, I'll give you a good discount if you do.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
I'm Steve Dotto. You are tuned in to Dotto Tech.
Dotto Tech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. You're listening to Dotto Tech, brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.
Joining me in studio now is Theo Horstall from London Drugs, and Microsoft is still in the peripheral game, and they've released a new touch mouse. Tell me about it.
Basically, take a mouse, cover the whole surface in a touch receptive material and use your fingers to navigate with the computer rather than moving the mouse, and you have the touch mouse.
So it kind of combines tablet and mouse all in one.
Right.
Now, Apple's had their Magic Mouse for a while. Now, I use one a fair bit, and it works pretty well for navigating through screens and things like that, certainly in their older version of the operating system. The newer version, they do even more. How does the touch mouse differ from the Magic Mouse?
So using the Magic Mouse as an example, Apple's taken two devices. So they have a Magic Mouse and a Magic Trackpad.
Yes.
And essentially what this is take those two devices into one device, and for Windows 7 exclusively, and you now have the Windows Touch Mouse. So it does things like not only works as a mouse, but then it adds gesturing with one, two, or three fingers to do different things within the operating system.
And that's the new buzzword, isn't it? Gestures.
It is.
Yeah. If you swipe back with two fingers, it means you want to move back in a web page. If you swipe back with three fingers, it means you want to move to a different screen or a different that kind of thing.
Yeah. And the neat thing about a device like this is you literally install it, and within minutes, it's taking you through a real quick tutorial. But I think with gesturing in general, if you go across any device, it's user friendly, and it comes naturally.
That that's an interesting thing that we should have a quick chat about, because so many people don't bother to learn to use the tools that they purchase or on their computer. I read a report I've got here somewhere that some phenomenal percentage, 90% of the people don't know how to use Control F when they're on a page to find something. You know, you just hit the Control F key and it pops up a little search window in the bottom of your web page so you can find that thing that you're looking for. 90% of users studied don't know how to use that. My concern with a product like this is I'm hoping people spend the time to go through the tutorial and learn to use it, and they don't just use it as a mouse that occasionally does strange things to them.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and I think I use. We mentioned another segment that I have a 5 and a 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about them is that they're instantly using their fingers to engage, a piece of technology. I feel that I think using gestures is natural. So, when you take somebody, you put them in front of a computer, show them a couple of simple gestures, it becomes more fun to use. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Control F. That doesn't sound very fun.
No, it is
not
fun.
Using your finger to swipe sideways or go backwards and forwards, it's fun.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that makes these newer interface devices essential is the screen real estate that we have to manage now. I mean, so many of us now don't have just a single screen, but we have double screens, and they're not just 15-inch screens, whether 17-inch, they're 19-inch, they're 23-inch. And all of a sudden, when you're looking at this massive amount of real estate that you have to move your mouse over and through and around and move the pointer to and navigate from window to window, we need a new way to do things. Remember, the mouse goes back to 1984, 83. When did Xerox PARC, when did they come up with the mouse?
Well, I don't think anybody used the Xerox PARC one, but sure.
Steve Jobs used it long enough to figure out how to do it to bring it across to the Mac. But
that's right.
Certainly we've had it now for the better part of 30 years. We've had the same user interface. So it's about time that we're finding new ways to interact. So you like it. You're a bit of a fan?
I like it because, obviously Microsoft has built into the operating system gesture or touch-based interface without really a way to capitalize on that. Mm-hmm. So here they have a device that allows you to unlock those capabilities within the OS. And I think somebody just using a standard keyboard or mouse may not ever get to experience that. Yes, you have to purchase something extra, but if it makes it a lot easier to use, mm-hmm. it's a natural for me.
Yeah, they're like $80 or so. And this is... This is if you have Windows 7.
It's designed specifically for Windows 7. It only works within Windows 7 for the gestures. Of course, you can use the mouse in pretty much anything else, but it's a very expensive mouse for that.
And it's a Bluetooth mouse, I take it?
Yes, it is wireless, absolutely.
Okay, perfect. So you can. So you guys have them on demo so people can come down and have a look?
I'm not sure if we have them on demo at this point.
Well, the guy, go and challenge the people to describe them to you. But I think certainly from using the Magic Mouse, I would have no issues at all taking advantage of that in Windows 7 and utilizing it. It probably, as you say, opens a whole bunch of new doors for people.
Sure.
Thanks so much. That's Theo Horstel from London Drugs. I think that you might be able to have a closer look if you drop in.
I'm sure you'll be able to.
Good. Art, I do believe the information density of this particular hour of radio was staggering.
A lot of ladies, too.
There was a lot of ladies, a lot of very smart ladies, yes. who've done some pretty good things. And boy, I learned a lot, and I think it was a great show. Reminder to people listening, drop by the website because we've still got the giveaway for the Echo Smart Pen. Which is just a terrific giveaway. And we're going to be setting up a giveaway to get a copy of The Healer. As long as you're willing to write a review. You got to write a review.
I can write a review.
And Art, this particular contest, you could win.
Are you serious?
You could win, yeah.
Oh, well, good luck to anyone else.
That is. That's it. That's all the time we have for this week. Next week, I think we're going to get Mike Kozlowski back on. We're going to talk about ebook readers, and we have a few other goodies up our sleeves. On behalf of Art Factora, I'm Steve Dotto. Thanks for tuning in.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.